From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So here we are, Christmas Eve, and Washington has yet to find a solution to avoid a plunge off the so-called fiscal cliff. It is a dangerous game of chicken that many fear could wreak havoc on the U.S. economy. Tax hikes are coming, spending cuts are coming, but the White House and Congress can't agree on a path of escape. In this season of giving, nobody's giving in. The president now in Hawaii, Congress in recess. This hour on Point, we're looking at where this could go in the year and days ahead. Joining me now from Washington are two reporters who have been all over the rough road to the cliff's edge. Major Garrett is now chief White House correspondent for CBS News. Major, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom, and happy holidays to everyone.
The best of the season to you, Major. And Nancy Cook is budget and tax correspondent for National Journal. Nancy Cook, welcome. Wonderful to have you here today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Okay, we know it's supposed to be all eggnog and cookies, but it is not. Let's listen to a few voices out there from this weekend. Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner telling CBS's Bob Schieffer here on Face the Nation yesterday that a little compromise to avoid the fiscal cliff would only delay big decisions on taxes and spending that current budget realities make unavoidable.
Remember, we took $4.5 trillion out of our revenue stream. We're only talking about, with the Bush tax cuts, we're only talking about putting about a third of that back in. At the same time, we doubled defense spending, created Homeland Security, created a new drug benefit, and we're all getting a lot older. We have to realize it's going to take revenues, spending cuts, and entitlement reform.
So you think they'll get past it?
I think we'll get past it, but we've got to get to the big deal.
All right. Well, get past it? Really? I'm not sure we see that coming on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday. Major Nancy here was New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer saying that he hoped for a deal. The conservative Republicans are making it difficult, that something would have to happen in the center here.
And my one bit of advice to Speaker Boehner is this. You cannot pass a bill with just Republicans. On a broad thing like this, you need both. And he has put himself with Plan B in sort of an impossible position. He has to get these hard right guys to go along with him. If he were to say, and the president were to say, we're going to pass a bill with a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans in the House and Senate, we could get a mainstream bill.
We could get a mainstream bill. Let's start right there. Major, do you see that possibility? Is there some sort of, you know, meeting in the middle here that would carve off the hard right, the left, whatever you want, and produce something in this handful of days? What, they're gone till Thursday now?
No, I really don't, Tom. If we're talking about a large structural deal that attempts to bring together a large new source of revenue, some structural reform of entitlements, and other issues that have long been debated in Washington but never resolved, I don't see that happening at all. I was optimistic a week ago, but I'm very pessimistic now. The political bandwidth in Washington is so narrow, the channels are so clogged up, people simply cannot vote, cannot bring themselves to any different position than the one they've staked out in the previous election or any election before that, if they had them. And that is the dominant reality in Washington. Paralysis is real. Inaction is the chosen form of legislative response, even to a crisis that is manufactured in Washington. Remember, this is not an external crisis. This is completely the product of legislative debate and action a year ago from the debt ceiling. The Budget Control Act set all this up. Okay, so this is Washington writing for the country a Christmas card that says, here is your 2013 recession. Love, Washington. Okay?
But this was set up with the explicit communication at the same time that we're setting up something so bad that we'll never do it. And so we'll come around and find some kind of deal.
Tom, I wrote a column around the time that the Budget Control Act was passed that called the super committee the biggest lie perpetrated by Washington against the American people. Well, I was wrong. That was the second largest. This is the largest. That we can't do it. It's so big, we'll never do it. Well, guess what? We're going to do it.
Nancy Cook, remind us what happens starting January 1st here, kind of across the board. Remind us what kicks in, why it's been called the cliff.
Sure. So there's a bunch of different tax and spending provisions that are going to basically take effect. So there's about $400 billion in tax cuts that are going to go away. So that's everything from the Bush-era tax cuts, which really reduced a lot of people's tax bills, as well as things like the alternative minimum tax. If it's not dealt with at the end of the year, 28 million new Americans will see their taxes go up. And all the tax pieces will affect about 90% of Americans will see their taxes rise. And then, of course, you have the sequester, which are these across-the-board mandated spending cuts. And half of those will hit the Defense Department, and then the other half will hit, you know, a whole bunch of different federal spending programs. So it could be everything from biomedical research to education, you know, things that people sort of take for granted that they just assume the federal government will do.
So let's look at those spending cuts for a moment, because, you know, you may have people saying, well, look, we've got a fiscal problem. It may not be nice, but maybe those spending cuts, maybe that's this sort of, you know, blind, dumb approach is what we need. Maybe it's the only way to cut.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, people have definitely thought that we need to think of a way to reduce government spending along with raise some revenue. That's, you know, the whole crux of the debate at this point. The problem with the sequester is that rather than do it in an artful way and say, you know what, we could take a little bit here or a little bit there, basically it just indiscriminately cuts across the board. And both parties actually agree that it's terrible policy. They don't think it's a good idea. And so there are areas of agreement like that, that this is just bad policy. Unfortunately, no one can bring themselves politically to undo it.
Long-term unemployment checks, I think, come to a screeching halt. How many people are affected by that? Who's depending on that?
Well, the scary thing is that's about 2 million people. That's according to what the White House estimates. And it's terrifying because these are people that have been unemployed. These are the long-term unemployed. So these are people that have been unemployed for 6 months or more. And a lot of these people are people in their 50s and 60s. Maybe they work blue-collar jobs or, you know, they haven't been able to necessarily get a toehold in the economy as the economy recovers. And a lot of that is because their jobs have gone away. You know, the economy structurally has changed in a lot of ways. And some of these middle-class blue-collar jobs have gone away. And so the loss of these unemployment benefits would hit people like that at a time when there's not a lot of stimulus money being pumped into the economy, nor are there any big political solutions to come up with ways to help these people.
Major, you're covering the White House. If the threat of recession is real out of this cliff, do you see business leaders streaming in the back door, the front door, the side door there, to Capitol Hill, for that matter, to say, don't let this happen?
Tom, they've already been there. They've been to the White House almost every week in the last 4 to 5 weeks. And if they come to the White House, they similarly venture up to Capitol Hill. Big business, small business, has said, look, whatever you do, don't impose this incredible complex set of tax increases and spending cuts that Nancy just summarized on the U.S. economy. And don't layer on to an already uncertain recovery a deeper layer of uncertainty. I mean, it's not just all the things that Nancy described. It's dividends and capital gains, which have investment components, what people will or will not do. There is a certain bit of about $22 or $23 billion of what are called tax extenders here in Washington. They are targeted pro-business, pro-growth tax policies.
Yep.
They're all supposed to go away. So all these things are heading toward the American taxpayer and those who are jobless. And big business has said, we'll give Republicans cover. We'll tell the country it's okay to vote for higher taxes in addition to all these other things. But here's the reality, Tom. Political cover isn't what it used to be. Big business, the Chamber of Commerce, other groups can't provide the kind of cover that makes a vote, a difficult vote, palatable.
Why is that?
There's a generation where it could. Because this is largely, and your listeners have heard this before, a concern about not Republican against Democrat general election, where that kind of cover works better, but Republican on Republican. And no amount of establishment beltway or pro-business or sort of organized out-of-the-district pronouncements or support for any member of Congress is going to guarantee them that they can survive a primary challenge. And for House Republicans, they have no political muscle memory voting for tax increases. The last time members of the Republican House, it was in a minority status back then, voted for a tax increase, was when George Herbert Walker Bush put the budget deal together with then Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and House Speaker Tom Foley. It might as well have been when the dinosaurs roamed the earth. Okay, so Republicans have no political experience testing the idea of even of a tax increase for millionaires. You know, they just so
even
they
with
no
Grover
experience.
Norquist signing off on that.
Exactly, that doesn't matter. So, and one thing I think we learned last week is that Grover doesn't represent the only fulcrum of power in Washington. Members got what they thought was a blessing from Grover Norquist on this, and it didn't matter. They still weren't going to vote for it.
Nancy, do you see a deal in the center out there somehow? Or could you peel off, you know, enough Republicans, bring in enough Democrats to whatever the sort of outliers or edges, big edges may say, a deal could be done?
Sure. I mean, the crazy thing is that, you know, in that movie, Dave, I don't know if you've ever seen that, where this pedestrian becomes president.
Yeah.
You know, he sort of goes through the budget and figures it out quite easily by taking things out. And an average American could sit down and cut this deal. No problem. I mean, you and I could cut it right now. And it wouldn't be that difficult. Even President Obama and Speaker Boehner, their latest offers are actually only about $400 billion apart, which I know sounds like a lot of money in theory, but, you know, we're talking about trillions of dollars here at stake over the next decade. And so they're not that far apart on paper. The numbers are pretty easy to manipulate at this point. It's really just the politics, and that's proving to be just insurmountable. And, you know, I, like Major, was very optimistic last week that we would be able to get a deal based on how close their offers were. But at this point, with everyone gone home, it's the holidays, we're fast approaching the new year, I just don't see any political will to actually get it done.
But they'll be back on Thursday, is that right, or do we know?
They're planning to be back. The Senate is planning to be back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking on Christmas Eve about the fiscal cliff fix that has not happened. Lots of finger pointing as we hurtle here on Fox News Sunday. Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso blamed the White House for the failure to reach a deal.
I think the president is eager to go over the cliff for political purposes. I think he sees a political victory at the bottom of the cliff. He gets all this additional tax revenue for new programs. He gets to cut the military, which Democrats have been calling for years, and he gets to blame Republicans for it. And when the president recently, and it was in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, talked about using the State of the Union and using his inaugural address to blame Republicans, that doesn't sound like somebody who's working with Republicans to find a solution. It's time for the president to lead.
It's time for the president to lead, says John Barrasso there. It's time for John Boehner to lead, says the White House. Major Garrett, you're at the White House covering there. Does it look to you that the president is eager to go over the cliff, that he sees, as the senator says, a political victory at the bottom of the cliff?
You know, look, I don't think you can look at the offers and counteroffers that have come from President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner and credibly say either wants to go off the cliff. I mean, both have moved off of hardened positions to try to reach an accommodation. And Nancy's 100% right. When you look at how close they've come from where they started, a deal can be made if there were the politics behind it to support it. I mean, look, the president campaigned all year for re-election, the first Democrat since before FDR, to campaign for re-election, not an original election, but re-election on a platform partially devoted to increasing income tax rates. He won.
Yeah.
And he set that threshold consistently and repeatedly at $250,000. He's gone since to $400,000. And he said in the press conference last week that $700,000 to $800,000 might be permissible. I mean, the president has moved way off a platform that he won re-election on. Plus, he added something which sounds very technical and may go over the heads of many listeners, but I'll try to summarize quickly, what's called chained CPI.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about it.
The Consumer Price Index is the way we increase on an annual basis Social Security and other benefits, railroad pensions and other things that the federal government pays out to those who qualify. And the Consumer Price Index is currently calculated in a certain way to give you a bump every year. This would be a less generous bump every year, and it would save money. President never campaigned on that. Many liberal Democrats hate that idea. He put that on the table for Speaker Boehner. Similarly, Speaker Boehner has given up on no income tax rates at all. He's gone to a million. And he gave up on the idea that he would not put into this deal raising the debt ceiling, which always was appeared to Republicans to be a point of leverage against the president.
Mm-hmm.
He put that on the table for a full year. So they've moved off their hardened positions. That's why Nancy and I, a week ago, as we watched this process of them moving off hardened positions and getting sort of creative and getting very deeply involved in all the various horse trading, thought, well, they're really close. They're on the cusp of a deal. And then it all fell apart.
Ray in Lansing, Michigan. Ray, thanks for calling. You're on the air on this Christmas Eve. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What do you think?
And Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays to you and the people over there.
Thank you very much.
By the way, you should have had these people on your show weeks ago. I agree with most of what they're saying concerning this so-called fiscal cliff. I'm calling just to put it in a real quick personal opinion. There is no such thing as a personal cliff, okay?
Oh, it's fiscal cliff, okay.
Fiscal cliff.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
What do I mean? Basically, this is a manufactured crisis forecast and supported by the media and most of the politicians.
So you think the tax hikes and the spending cuts that are coming by law will not have economic downside, Ray?
They'll have an economic downside for about 2 weeks. If the Democrats are intelligent, they can overturn this after they come back in with a new Congress.
Can't do it alone.
And also what the talking heads, especially the Republican talking heads, the media is not telling the people that the fiscal cliff does not touch Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security, which means a large portion of the United States is not in, it's not affected by the fiscal cliff.
Ray, let us pick it up. Nancy, it's not as big a deal as everybody says. Let's not worry. A couple weeks, it'll blow over. What do you say, Nancy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's not entirely accurate. You know, the Congressional Budget Office, which is this nonpartisan agency in Washington that does a lot of measurements of how different budget things will affect the economy, you know, months ago predicted that if we go over the cliff, let's say, and all these tax hikes take effect and all these spending cuts take effect, the economic growth is slated to slow down enough that it will plunge us back potentially into a recession. Unemployment will rise. And this has been a widespread view among economists. And I think that's pretty scary for most Americans because in addition to facing tax hikes, the economy is really just starting to recover. And we've seen the unemployment rate tick down. We've seen, you know, some excellent economic numbers in the last few weeks. And it's kind of scary that when we're finally at this cusp of, okay, things look better, you know, people's personal pocketbooks and economic outlook is getting better, suddenly we could go back into a recession in 2013.
And Tom, let me raise another point.
Yeah.
And I get Ray's sense, and I think it's reflective of how much of the country thinks that Washington manufactures just about every crisis, and that there's something that is worthy to be skeptical about whenever Washington talks about something that's big. I get that. But let's just talk about the non-defense discretionary part of the budget, these across-the-board spending cuts.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about things like food safety, okay? Let's say you're ordered at your agency to cut by 12% instantly or 10%.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's 15 inspectors or 5 or 10 are furloughed instantly furloughed. Well, that's actual government activity devoted to safety, and it applies to the Food and Drug Administration, applies to everything.
In a season when people are making eggnog, it makes you think.
whatever season of the year. Food safety, I think, is, for most Americans, a constant, and drug safety is a constant, never-ending issue. And so it's not just the economic effects. There are things the federal government does and does relatively well. Centers for Disease Control. I'm not saying that these things will collapse, but they'll be cut, and they'll be cut instantly, and they'll be cut in a way that forces people to have a job and then be furloughed and then all the disruptive things that come after that.
And we've already seen problems in both these areas, food and drug safety.
Sure, exactly. And so it's the taxes. And one other thing, and Ray may be thinking about this, one issue that hasn't come up on all this, the payroll tax, the 2% payroll tax cut, is not part of any of these discussions, and it's going to end. Mm-hmm. We've had that for 2 years, which gives everyone about $30 to $40 a month extra, maybe larger depending on how much the 2% payroll tax was applied to your earnings. That's going to go away. So that's a tax increase for everyone. There are other aspects of this that are not being discussed as readily as the things that Nancy and I have talked about before. But I think the economic consequences are all too real, and the governmental impacts will be felt in ways that may surprise and dismay a lot of Americans.
And here we sit. It's going to be very interesting to see how the markets really take this on board. Davis in Franklin, Tennessee. Davis, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I am a Republican, small business owner, job creator, etc. And in my opinion, the only question is how far does the market go down before the Republicans, the economic neocons, buckle at the knees?
What do you fear or foresee, Davis?
I would say 2,000 points.
That would get everybody's attention. I mean, then we're back into sort of 08, 07 territory.
Because the Tea Party, Grover Norquist, et cetera, are facing an existential crisis that if increased taxes are imposed and the economy improves, then they're
undercut.
That undercuts their philosophical basis of trickle-down economics.
Well, you're a Republican, Davis. What about, you know, the people in exactly that camp saying, look, we have, yes, this is dangerous, but we have to do something about spending. We're going to draw the line here, and come hell or high water, we're going to stick with it. Is that just unrealistic, Davis, or is it, do they have a point?
You know, if my fellow Republicans had ever cut spending on their own, I might believe that. But throughout, as long as I've been watching politics, about 40 years, they have spent actually more lavishly than Republicans.
Davis, than Democrats, I guess you're saying there. You're a level head. I kind of wish you were in there, but thanks for calling. Hope you're wrong. Nancy Cook, are people talking about that kind of potential smack up the side of the head? You know, a great big, Davis says, 2,000-point loss in the Dow. Does that seem overwrought, or is that danger out there?
Yeah, well, I talked to a bunch of economists and bankers in New York on Friday because I was curious about the same thing. What were they thinking as, you know, everything was sort of collapsing around us here in Washington and in Congress, and the hopes for a deal seemed to be going away. And I talked to a bunch of people, and they basically said, look, you know, we're not that stressed out about the fiscal cliff. We definitely don't want, you know, there to be too much fiscal drag on the economy. But basically what the business community in Wall Street is looking for is some sense of certainty. They don't need a huge grand deal that overhauls all the entitlements right now and reduces the deficit. They just want some sense of certainty so that come 2013, people sort of know what their tax rates are, businesses know what their tax rates are. And what really freaks out the business community in Wall Street much more than the fiscal cliff is a debt ceiling fight come February or March. And that's sort of what we're gearing up for now. If we go over the fiscal cliff, the sense is, oh, well, we'll just resolve these things in the debt ceiling. And that really freaks out Wall Street because it could lead to a potential credit downgrade. And then there's a whole bunch of things that triggers in the market. And then it also, there's a sense that we're just going to be in this era of permanent fiscal cliffs where we never resolve anything. We don't resolve anything with the fiscal cliff. We move on to the debt ceiling in a month and a half, 2 months, have exactly the same fights again. And so it's sort of this deja vu of the past 2 years of more and more tax and budget fights where there's no resolution in sight.
Boy, it makes you want to run off to the eggnog in a hurry and forget it, but we can't. It's going to come back. Major, what about this fear of the markets saying, look, I mean, the markets are going up pretty handsomely this year. And not that that's a measure of everything, but that was based on the idea that people would sober up in the face of this and get something together and we'd keep on climbing out of the hole. Do you hear that kind of talk out there of some big whack that would set everybody back on their heels?
Not of that magnitude, not of the 2,000-point magnitude. And I think Nancy's right. The next great horizon that the business community and Wall Street is looking at is the debt crisis. And that's why when Speaker Boehner put it on the table and said, you know, Mr. President, we'll grant you a ceasefire. He said a year. The president came back at two. All three of us can say, what's in between 1 year and 2 years?
Yeah.
Hey, 18 months. How about that? Mm-hmm. You know, it was all of it was visible based on what they were proposing.
We won't fight you for a year and a half or to 1 or 2 or something.
Right,
but we'll
exactly.
give you a free period. Yep.
Right, exactly, which was an enormous political concession for the speaker. Turned out to be too large because that wasn't even in his plan B. And if he couldn't get taxes raised for $1 million and higher, not including a debt ceiling ceasefire, imagine how difficult adding that into it would be for the equation. I think the market has priced in paralysis very well. I think it's well practiced in pricing in paralysis. And so as prospects on Thursday and certainly Friday diminished for a deal, I think the market said, well, here's another moment to sigh, here's another moment to shrug, and here's another moment to just move on and try to understand how we can function in a world where Washington is far more indecisive than decisive. And look, Tom, check out what many corporations did in early December. They began paying out dividends much earlier than they would have.
Yeah.
Corporate dividends because they wanted to award dividends at a tax structure more favorable to those who would receive it. Now, that was changing their entire investment strategy and payout strategy because they assumed Washington would get nothing done. Some corporations held on and will pay out dividends under a new tax structure next year, but many just paid out dividends because they're like,
take
Washington's not going to figure this out anyway.
Yeah. Here, you know, The question, though, of why not act on something here and spare a lot of people from a tax hike, which seems like a Republican idea, is sitting out there. You've got Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina Senate Republican, yesterday. This is on NBC's Meet the Press, saying, hey, come on, Republicans, make a deal now. Save a lot of people from a tax hike. It's worth it. Here's Lindsey Graham.
To my Republican colleagues, the Ronald Reagan model is if you get 80% of what you want, that's a pretty good day. We have the same objective of lower taxes. I like Simpson-Bowles. Eliminate deductions, lower rates, put money on the debt. Tax rate hikes are a partisan solution driven by the president, but he's going to get tax rate hikes. To my Republican colleagues, if we can protect 99% of the American public from a tax hike, that is not a tax increase in my book.
What about it, Major? I mean, Jason writes to us online, says, you know, sort of head-scratching, why aren't the Republicans doing it if it means saving a lot of people from a tax hike?
Well, there are some Republicans now who've come to believe, look, the politics for Republicans on the fiscal cliff have been bad since Election Day, and they've only gotten worse. By about a 2-to-1 margin, roughly across the polls, the president is viewed as less responsible for driving the nation over the fiscal cliff than Republicans. So there are some Republicans who look at this and say, well, we're already getting the snot knocked out of us on this. Let's go over the cliff, and the president will then have to bear some of this burden. He will have to explain to the country why, as president, he couldn't resolve this. And perhaps he will then have to take on some of the downdraft politically of going over the fiscal cliff, of not being the national leader, of not being able to bring people together, about not being able to achieve other things that are on his agenda. And look, there are some Republicans who are not interested in other debates like immigration, gun control. And as long as the fiscal cliff is dominant, or fiscal issues, generally speaking, are dominant, they're more content with those politics. And they think after the first, if in fact we go over the cliff and there is no deal, then the pressure begins to be shared somewhat more equitably, they would argue, and they would hope the president has to bear some of that burden and then come back to them maybe. But that's a wish and a hope and a theory, which we have no general evidence to support, but I will tell you that's become a practicing theory among Republicans and one of the reasons they were not prepared to back the speaker last week.
But doesn't leverage shift, Nancy? Because after January 1st, these hikes will already be there. The president said he wants more revenue. He didn't want all that, but now they'll be, instead of, you know, keeping things from going up, they'll be arguing over how much to take them down.
Yeah, that's one theory that's been going around. I mean, and it's true. It's accurate, because basically what happens at that point is all these tax hikes, you know, happen. And then it basically means that the Republicans, it's just sort of a way of salesmanship, right? So it means the Republicans can go back and say, rather than they voted for a tax hike, they can say, oh, we voted for a tax cut. Because at that point, you know, they'll just be restoring tax cuts probably for people under the $250,000 income threshold. And it's, you know, to people outside of Washington, it just looks like, wow, this is a crazy game of semantics that politicians in Washington are playing. But it is really important to Republicans, particularly House Republicans, because they don't want to say, as Major said before, you know, they don't want to face a primary challenge where someone can come in and say, we voted for, you know, tax hike on people.
It's Christmas Eve on the fiscal cliff. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point on Christmas Eve, and here we are talking about the fiscal cliff that has not happened and what will, might happen here in the last days of 2012, the first days of 2013. Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News, is with us today. Nancy Cook, Budget and Tax Correspondent for the National Journal, is here. Benjamin's calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Hi, Benjamin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Excellent show as always.
Thank you
very much. I have a question.
Yeah.
We are running red ink about $1 trillion a year. Plus, Fed is spending about $100 billion a month on treasuries and mortgages. So that's about a couple $1 trillion a year.
Yeah.
In the next 6-7 years, we're going to double our deficit to about $30 trillion. And I think we're guaranteed that we will have our Greek moment before that. And we're discussing, we're spending all that time discussing $1 trillion for the next 10 years. It's probably, 4-5% of overall problem. It looks like a bump, not a cliff. Cliff is going to come later. So could you guys please explain to us why are we discussing so much thing that seems to be so small comparing to overall problem we have.
Oh, Benjamin, Merry Christmas to you, too. As bad as it is, it's nothing. This is just a speed bump. The real problem is down the road. Oh, my gosh. But okay, fair enough. I mean, are we all up in arms, Nancy, about, you know, a relative trifle in the great scheme of things? It's Benjamin's concern. You hear where he's going.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. So there's a lot of things there. So let's just unpack them for a second. So one is, you know, he's saying, oh, we're going to be like Greece, or we're going to be like some of these European countries that have had this huge issue with their debt and deficit. And the thing is, right now, that is actually not a threat. I know that a lot of Republicans say, oh, we're going to enter this Greece debt crisis. That's just not true.
Why right is now, that not a threat? You hear the numbers he's rolling out, a couple of trillion a year between deficit and Fed spending, he's saying, and there you go.
It's not true because right now the U.S. is a safe haven for everyone else's money. So, you know, other countries are having issues. They're having austerity crises. They're cutting spending. You know, it's leading them into a recession. This is happening in Great Britain. This is happening in Spain. This is happening in Greece. And so the U.S. is still seen as a very safe place to invest your money. It's still seen as responsible. The government is still seen as, you know, semi-functional outside of the U.S. And so there's this safe haven concept where, you know, people are not going to stop investing in the U.S. because of that. On the caller's second point about sort of getting our deficit under control over the long term, it's true that we do need to get our deficit in control. And part of that is by potentially raising some revenue or potentially cutting spending or doing some combination of the two. The big thing is that baby boomers are starting to retire en masse and take advantage of all the federal health care programs. And we haven't really figured out how to keep those health care costs low at this point or sort of lower mm-hmm. them and control them. Mm-hmm. And that's really going to be the challenge over the next 10 or 20 years. How can we do that? And that's really the way to tackle spending. But that's an issue for the next decade or the next 20 years, not something that's going to happen next year.
Major, Nancy sounds soothing. Benjamin and his numbers do not. Are we looking at a pebble while there's a boulder rolling toward us here? Or what do you think?
Well, I had many favorite colleagues at National Journal. Nancy was among my most favorite because she is so smart and so soothing. So yeah. She's right.
Okay.
But both can be right in looking at this. You can look at the numbers that Benjamin talked about and feel vaguely or quite specifically terrified. But what Nancy said is positively
Merry Christmas
true.
To you too.
Yeah.
Exactly. What Nancy said is positively true. Not only are the United States, generally speaking, in the world economy a safe haven. It is moving. It has moved out of the Iraq War. It is going to, in the next year and a half, move out of Afghanistan. The entrenched costs there, the savings there, will be up to $1 trillion over the next decade. So we're spending less on war fighting. Mm. We'll have to spend money on the warriors who come home, and that will be an embedded budget cost, but less than it is to fight and prosecute those wars. Our own borrowing costs have never been lower. I mean, you could make an economic argument. It would have no sale politically, but you could make an economic argument right now that this is the time to do massive borrowing on behalf of infrastructure.
Build out the infrastructure. Listen, when I look at the infrastructure, that doesn't sound so crazy when you look
because
at the shape
it's never
it's
been
in.
Cheaper for this country to go into debt, structural smart debt, what you do in your own home. You go into mm-hmm. debt to remodel or rebuild something because it creates more efficiency or more living space or something else that's
if the water tank is leaking,
you
replace it. If the hot water
right.
heater is leaking, yeah.
And some economists do make this argument, but the political bandwidth is so narrow, we can't get there. But we maybe ought to have a more robust debate about that. And Benjamin's, I think, most salient point is, why is this such a miniaturized debate in comparison to the larger structural mm-hmm. issues? Because that's all our politics can handle, and it can't even handle that. To show you where we are in this sort of thing and to lighten the mood just a little bit, before I was on Face the Nation yesterday, I was conversing with some very senior Senate Democratic aides who were close to what's happening, and one of them said to me, it's like the Princess Bride. Remember when Miracle Max came out and looked at Wesley on the plate and said, well, this guy's nearly dead, okay? He's not dead, but he's nearly dead, and it's going to take a miracle to save him. Well, that's where we are with a very small thing to avert the fiscal cliff. It's nearly dead. And if Miracle Max doesn't show up in the next 72 hours, it's going to stay dead.
Look, here a listener writes online. He says, I find it interesting that we call it a fiscal cliff instead of what it really is, the Americans' first attempt at austerity measures, and more are coming. You know, here's that view, Major, that, you know, this is what we're lined up for. This is the first, we're taking the medicine here. This is our first dose of it. We don't like it, but there's more to come. What about that view, Major?
Well, let me explain where the fiscal cliff came from. and it's part of my humiliation as a writer. I wrote a column a long time ago adding up all these things that were going to come due at the end of this year that I knew Congress wasn't going to deal with before the election. Mm. And I said, this is going to be the lame duck session from hell. And it listed all the things, fiscal and spending and everything. And then about 2 weeks later, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, was testifying before the Hill, and somebody asked him generally about all these things. And Ben Bernanke came up with now the phrase that pays, fiscal cliff. You have no idea how humiliating it is to be someone who aspires to be a wordsmith and be out-wordsmitted by the chairman of the Federal
chairman.
Reserve.
Yes. The most mystifying, stultifying speakers in the world.
Interesting person in American political and economic life. So he called it the fiscal cliff. But the writer, the email author, is correct. This will have the feel of austerity. Now, it's not austerity like they're going through in Europe where pension benefits are slashed by 15, 10, 20%, cumulatively over 4 or 5 years, nearly 40%. We're not talking about anything like that at all, but it is encroachment, austerity at the margins, if you will. And it could have an economic effect. It could have a disruptive government impact. And it may be that 10 days after in January, people look at it and come to their senses and are more willing to move. But right now, they look and sound and act as if they're entrenched enough to go off the cliff and then see what happens.
We'll look at the other side. Forrest in Lexington, Kentucky is calling. Hi, Forrest. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question, I'm a member of the middle class. Is it better for me to just go ahead, for us to stop kicking the proverbial can down the road, or is it better to just go ahead and bite the bullet, cut federal programs, and raise taxes? Because it seems to me we put put two wars on credit cards, and then Obama bailed out everybody and their brother, so we have to pay our bills. What's your thoughts on that?
Forrest, I appreciate your call. Nancy, I mean, it's just, it practically brings tears to my eyes to hear.
How,
but people are ready to step, if they knew with certainty that what it took to fix things was pain. Here's Forrest. It sounds like he's ready to do it. On the other hand, if this is unnecessary pain and widespread pain, and it's imposed on people just out of kind of fecklessness or rigidity in Washington, that seems a terrible way to take advantage of that citizen's willingness to step up if that's what's needed.
Yeah, and I think the caller makes a great point. I mean, the problem is that we've promised more than we can pay for, right? And so we've promised all these healthcare benefits over the long run to all these people that we don't necessarily have the money over the long run to pay for. And we've also promised people, hey, your taxes aren't going to go up because we're a country that doesn't tax people, you know, as much. Our federal revenue is at a 20-year low. Corporate tax rates are at a very low period at this point. And so over the long run, what's going to happen is that people will most likely have to pay higher taxes. And that will include not just millionaires, but probably people in the middle class. And then what also is going to happen is people will have to see their structural entitlement benefits changed in some way. Medicare 20 years from now may not look the same. Same thing for Medicaid, potentially. Same thing for Social Security. But the thing is that if there's political will to do some of these things now, you can phase these changes in so that they don't happen immediately. These can be things that happen gradually and slowly over the next decade rather than January 1st.
But, Major, I mean, Nancy may be exactly right, wise as you say, but it can sound defeatist. I mean, isn't there a strategy to fire up the economy, to come in and take measures to cut back on waste, on spending in healthcare that we don't need?
Oh, sure. And if there's one irony here that really does and ought to bring tears to all of our eyes, it's this. When the business community talks to the political class, the president, Speaker Boehner, Majority Leader Harry Reid, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, they tell them one thing over and over and over again. Look, this economy is poised, if not for greatness, for something that looks a lot better than it's felt and been experienced for the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, let's do that,
and
for heaven's sake.
And if you get a deal, that will help us move the economy ever more rapidly in that very positive direction. If you don't give us a deal, you're going to hamstring the grinding recovery we've had as we're trying to push up and out and get to a better place. If you get a deal and we have some certainty for the next 5 to 10 years, things will get unleashed.
Well, what about the House Republicans? Why don't they want? I mean, here's Lynn writes, Republicans in the House are an abomination. If the business guys in this case, this is their turf, if they're right, what is the point of standing in the way of that?
The point is self-preservation.
Politically.
They don't believe they can vote this way and survive politically. And self-preservation is the dominant principle motivation of everyone in politics.
What about national preservation?
To one degree or another. Well, until they have a different experience. Like I said, it's very important that when people have no experience doing something, look, ask yourself this question. How easy is it to change something fundamental in your life? Most honest people would say, not that easy.
Yeah, you know, but most people don't bring on calamity before they wise up. Most people don't. They sit down, they soberly assess.
That's true. And so there has yet to be this moment of recognition of a different or potentially different reality. But before I let you go, Tom, I want to say, I think perhaps unwittingly, you have not only given us the headline for this entire hour, but the name of a great potential garage band, Feckless Rigidity.
Gosh, I don't know where to go with that one. Listen, let us, you say look 10 days into the new, let's pitch this forward a couple of weeks. We're on the other side of the cliff, whatever that means. We've begun to see it. We've begun to feel it. We're in it. How do the politics change, Nancy? What might happen in the middle of January that is not happening now, cannot happen so far?
Well, the politics become easier in January because Republicans don't have to violate this fundamental party orthodoxy that they have about not voting for tax increases.
Because they'll just be there.
Yeah, they'll just be there. The tax hikes are going to happen. So starting, you know, January 2nd.
That was the plan that George W. Bush pushed into effect when the cuts came.
Exactly.
The rehikes were right in there, though I think he kind of assumed it would not happen. But he didn't want to take the hit to the budget numbers, I guess, that would suggest. So, but if they're there, then what happens? What's possible?
Then it's so easy for the Republicans to come in and say, oh, you know what? We're going to vote for tax cuts. You know, these are going to be tax cuts. If you make, you know, more than $250,000 a year, you know, you'll see it'll just be a tax hike that automatically happens on these people. But then the Republicans can sell
it.
And that's so important, how you sell it. They can sell it and say, oh, look at us. We've just passed these tax cuts for middle class people, people that make under $250,000, small businesses. And that's a great selling point for them.
Well, if it's that easy, maybe this is all just a bunch of fake anxiety here, because in 15 days or 20, we can just do it from the other side.
I think that that's accurate. I mean, you know, it is a risk, and you're not sure how long it will take them to do that. I mean, look, we've been debating the fiscal cliff in Washington for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks now, and we haven't really gotten anywhere. And so the risk with going over the cliff and just assuming it will be easy is that, you know, come January 4th or 10th or 15th, what actual deal can you cut? And is it just going to be a tiny one where you do tax cuts for a small number of people? What about all these other provisions that Major and I have been talking about, like the business breaks for research and development, or
but why not
you know, the
do
unemployment
a lot,
insurance? I mean,
Major, after we all sing Auld Lang Syne, maybe this is a piece of cake.
Oh, no, it's not. We should not kid ourselves about that. And look, I take Nancy's point, and I think there are some Republicans who do believe the politics are easier after this. But look, if I'm a Republican strategist running to run against someone in Congress now in a primary, I say, well, your first vote was for the Budget Control Act last year, which set all this in motion. So you voted for the highest, largest, most economically damaging tax increase in American history. Yeah, sure, you peeled it back a little bit, but you still voted for it. I mean, I still think the politics of tax increases, once the taxes go up, are very difficult for Republicans. And the fact is, unless you get the Speaker and the President together, knitted in the same room in relationship to some tax rate revenue increases, and if not structural entitlement reform, something that moves in that direction, or something that provides a legislative imperative to do it in 6 or 8 months, which they were working on, all these issues keep getting revisited. The imposed uncertainty in our economy continues. And let me just tell you, as a practical matter, the IRS is going bananas right now, because the IRS does not know what to do with its tax forms, its rates, schedules, or anything. And it is an enormously complex job in this country to collect and creditably and with the least amount of public dissatisfaction. There is some, but it could be much larger if the IRS doesn't know what it's doing and isn't told under law what it's doing.
Look,
and if you change tax rates in January or February and then rewrite them and it's all retroactive, I mean, just ask a tax planner right now what kind of life they
I can only imagine
for themselves.
Look, here we are. We're on the eve of what is for many Americans quite a sacred day. If people of the praying type, Major, What should they pray for in the face of all this?
Leadership. Leadership and courage, and the essential element of nation before party.
Will it be Speaker Boehner come January 4th? Will it still be this Speaker of the House?
Oh, yes. Forget all that. All that stuff about Speaker Boehner being in jeopardy is complete nonsense. Look, if the Speaker wanted to get in jeopardy, he would force people to vote on Plan B or have Democrats help him pass it. That's the way to ending your speakership. He didn't do that. He deferred to his conference and let their will carry out.
But
he
that will...
A terrible hit for it. Yeah, but, yeah. But he let them have their way. A Speaker who lets his conference have his way is not headed to the exits.
Season of hope. Season of peace. We're looking for both here today and grateful to the two of you for helping us look forward just as best we can. Major Garrett, thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, always a pleasure.
Major Garrett with CBS at the White House and Nancy Cook at the National Journal. Thanks so much, Nancy.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Sam, to you. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.